Worldwide, nearly 200,000 babies each year are born with congenital clubfoot. The gold standard treatment for clubfoot is the Ponseti method, developed at the University of Iowa. It's nearly 100% effective. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Iowa Week continues this hour with a look at pioneering work in medicine and some of the latest medical developments in the state. We'll hear about the Iowa-based Ponseti International Association, Iowa's statewide perinatal care program, and the remarkable story of how the University of Iowa's College of Medicine was funded almost 100 years ago. A look at Iowa and medicine right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and Iowa Week continues here on River to River this hour with a look at pioneering work in medicine. And we'll start off, though, with some of the latest developments in the state in just a moment. But later on, we'll hear about the Iowa-based Ponseti International Association, the difference it's making in the world. And we'll talk about the life of Ignacio Ponseti. Also, Iowa statewide perinatal care program, where its origins are in the 1970s. It helps mothers and newborn babies receive needed medical care across the state. Also, the remarkable story of how the University of Iowa's College of Medicine was funded almost 100 years ago. But first, let's do talk about some new medical developments in the news tied to Iowa. And joining us first of all to do that, Dr. Patricia Winokur is Associate Dean for Clinical and Translational Science at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. She joins us by phone. Dr. Winokur, hi.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. You are studying a new vaccine, I understand, and it's a vaccine for a worrying new strain of influenza called H7N9. Where and when was this new strain identified?
So this is a strain that was identified again in China, and it was identified in April, where they started seeing a bird strain, an avian strain of influenza, that had then started to infect people. So far, it's only infected about 140 people, but unfortunately, it's had a very high mortality rate where about a third of them have died once they've been infected.
Mm-hmm. So when this strain is identified, what are the things that put it on your radar for people around the world watching for potentially really worrying strains? What about this worries us?
So there are a couple things about this particular strain that are very worrisome. One is it's a strain that our human population has never seen before. And if it can acquire the ability to spread person to person, this could be a very lethal pandemic where it would spread around the world.
Because our bodies, you say we've never seen it before, our bodies, it would be an alien, and our bodies would not know how to defend whatsoever against it.
Exactly. And we also know from prior studies with these types of avian strains of influenza, our immune system just doesn't respond to these strains very well.
Doesn't even know it's there? Doesn't even set off the alarm bells?
It sets off the alarm bells, but not as potently as it does to other strains that have been more commonly circulating in the population.
Okay, so we have a potentially very worrisome strain, and worst-case scenario, before we get to talk about the vaccine that you're studying, worst case scenario, we're looking at a pandemic, right?
That's always the worst case scenario with influenza, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So tell us, you're looking at a new vaccine to help stem this. Tell us about that.
So we've done studies with a lot of these avian strains, and we know that the immune response to these vaccines is very poor. And we expect that to be the case again with this H7N9 strain of virus. Mm-hmm. So the vaccine that we're testing is going to include an adjuvant, and the adjuvant is a compound called MF59. Adjuvants actually help the body respond better to vaccine proteins.
So there's something you add to the
Exactly.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it kind of jump starts the immune response to these unusual strains of flu.
Mm-hmm. So when you are studying this new vaccine, what are the questions you want to answer?
So what we're trying to answer is, do we need to add adjuvant? And if we do, what's the best dose of flu protein that we need to use to get the proper immune response that we think will protect people. So we're looking at a number of people will be enrolled in different arms, we call them, and get different doses, and some will get adjuvant and some won't.
Mm-hmm. And what is the timeline you're looking at that you need to have this done?
So this is a very urgent trial. The government has decided that this is a high priority for us. So we're trying to enroll 175 people in about 3 weeks.
Okay. And can our listeners help out, or should our listeners know anything? Because we're coming up on flu season, right? And some people are already getting flu shots.
So this flu vaccine would not protect them against the strains that we anticipate to circulate this year in the 2013-14 flu year. So this is a special flu vaccine, and for people who are interested in participating, we need them to hold off on their vaccine or at least have gotten it 2 weeks before. And so, but if they're interested in participating, we are still looking for volunteers, and they can call 319-356-4848 if they're interested.
But to be clear, Dr. Winokur, in Iowa, do we have any reported cases in the U.S.?
Absolutely not. This is an anticipation that this strain might acquire those abilities to spread person to person. We're hoping it doesn't, but we want to be prepared in case it does.
But for the known flu strains that people can encounter in Iowa or in the United States, the flu shots this year are good to go, right?
Exactly, and they're actually already distributed, so people can start getting them now if they're interested.
Okay, very good. Dr. Patricia Winokur, give us that number, too, where people can, you're looking for what type of people and how can they get in touch?
So we're looking for people that are 19 to 64 years of age and in generally good health. And they can call us at 319-356-4848.
Dr. Patricia Winokur, Associate Dean for Clinical and Translational Science at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Iowa Week. I hope you're enjoying it as much as we are here, the talk show team. We're looking this hour at pioneering work in medicine, also some of the latest medical developments in the state. Let's keep on with the present day, turning back to our phones to talk to Dr. Stuart Weinstein. He is the Ignacio Ponseti Chair and Professor of Orthopedic Surgery, also Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. Dr. Weinstein, are you there?
I am. Good morning, Ben.
Yeah, good afternoon. We're just into the afternoon. Good afternoon to you, Dr. Weinstein. And you've been on the faculty at the University of Iowa since the mid-1970s. You're a pediatric orthopedic surgeon. You specialize in treating children with spinal deformities, I understand. And now you are the lead author of the study titled Effect of Bracing in Adolescents with Idiopathic Scoliosis. And it's published last week in the New England Journal of Medicine. Now, before we talk about this new study, have you explain us to us scoliosis? Remind us what that is.
Yeah, there are many types of scoliosis, Ben, but the most common type that children get is called adolescent idiopathic scoliosis. It affects children equally, boys and girls, between the ages of 10 and 15 years. So it's actually very common. If you had a school of 1,000 kids, 20 to 30 would have adolescent idiopathic scoliosis.
In fact, one of my children had it. It was identified. This is what the nurse looks at when she's going through, and as you take your shirt off, and she's looking at your spine, and what do you kind of bend over and look for, the curvature?
Yes, exactly. You're looking for rotational changes in the body, which give the physician or the screener the idea that the child may or may not have a spinal deformity.
Mm-hmm. And if not treated, what could happen?
Well, actually, the majority of kids who have scoliosis, this type of scoliosis, don't need treatment. But those who are affected and are at high risk of progression, left untreated, may get very severe deformities, which could affect lung function, could cause significant back pain, and may affect their life profoundly as adults.
Okay. You're the lead author of this new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine last week. What does it tell us about the treatment for idiopathic scoliosis?
Well, interestingly, I've been treating scoliosis for the last 38 years, and the standard of non-surgical treatment, that is trying to prevent kids from getting to a curvature that would require surgery, has been a brace. But a brace, even though it's been used for more than 60 years, was never proven to be effective. So this study essentially looked at the effectiveness of bracing in children who are at high risk of having a curve that would progress to a level that might need surgery.
Mm-hmm. So the message here, what needs to be adjusted in terms of treatment, that too many children are being given a brace when they don't need?
Well, I think doctors like myself were unsure, do braces work or do they not work? Because there was never really a high-level trial of bracing versus observation to determine whether braces are effective or not. So there are many doctors who treat scoliosis who said, well, if it doesn't work, why should I use it? And others felt, well, even if it's not proven to work, how can I afford not to use it? So this study basically addressed definitively whether braces will prevent children who are at high risk for progression of their curve, for the curve getting to a level that would require surgery.
Mm-hmm. And so those listening in the medical profession should hear what from this study, should change practice. How?
Well, it'll definitively change practice because it showed that bracing significantly decreased the progression of high-risk curves to a threshold for surgery in patients with scoliosis, this type of scoliosis. The other thing it showed was that the longer the child or the more the child wore the brace, the greater the benefit. So the children who wore their brace more than 13 hours a day had a 90 to 93% success rate.
Okay. And when we look to the future, what are some burning questions about this type of scoliosis that you'd like to have answered in the future with future studies?
Well, if in the future, we need to know what causes it. We have a pretty good idea. It's probably genetic in nature. But the other thing we need to do is that we need to better define who's the actual ideal patient who would benefit from a brace. So even though we've shown that bracing is beneficial and does prevent the need for surgery, we need, and hopefully over the next year, we'll be able to analyze our data such that we'll be able to actually determine who's the very best candidate for a brace to prevent surgery from being needed in the future.
Talk a little bit more about the causes of this type of scoliosis. You said you have a pretty good idea that it's genetically based, not based on sort of habits we get into in our posture in grade school, those years.
Yeah, those are common misconceptions, but this type of scoliosis most likely has a genetic basis to it.
Okay. And past that, we don't know anything about what types of people it affects or what ethnic groups, for instance?
Well, it actually affects boys and girls equally, but it is most common that the children who wind up needing treatment are usually the adolescent females.
Okay. Thank you very much for keeping us up to date. I understand you're joining us from Paris. Thank you for calling in.
My pleasure.
Dr. Stuart Weinstein, the Ignacio Ponseti Chair and Professor of Orthopedic Surgery, Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. It's Iowa Week, looking at some of the latest medical developments and connected with Iowa there with Dr. Stuart Weinstein. But also we want to look back in history at some of the medical advances connected with our state. And when we do that, we cannot avoid and do not want to avoid talking about this next item with Dr. Jose Morquende. He is the chief medical director of the Ponseti International Association. Dr. Morquende, welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you, Ben.
Nearly 200,000 babies each year are born with congenital club foot, and the gold standard treatment for clubfoot is the Ponseti method. It was developed at the University of Iowa by Ignacio Ponseti. He died in 2009. He first came to the U.S. and to the United States in 1940. Well, he came to the United States in 1941, the University of Iowa, I understand, 1990. You came to the University of Iowa in 1990. Sorry. Dr. Ponseti came in 1941. Tell us about your relationship with him and perhaps better, to tell us what is clubfoot. Remind us what that is.
Well, clubfoot is a deformity that the kids are born with, and the word comes from the deformity because the foot looks like a club, so it's completely twisted in. So in some cases, actually, the sole of the foot can be touching the leg. This is a deformity that happened in about 1 in 1,000 kids. So when you look at the numbers, about 200,000 kids are born in the world. But the numbers are a little bit, it might have some more meaning. You divide that by the time, the hours. So every 3 minutes, there's a kid that is born somewhere in the world with a cleft foot deformity.
Mm-hmm. You identify this, of course, at birth, but can you identify it also in the womb?
Yes. Now with the ultrasounds and the prenatal diagnosis, cleft foot can be identified during pregnancy, usually around 20, 24 weeks.
Mm-hmm. If not treated, what happens with to a child as a child develops with club foot?
If treatment is not provided to the child, then when they start walking, they will walk with, instead of with the sole of the foot, they will be walking with the upper part of the foot, with the foot completely twisted.
Mm-hmm.
And that results in a very difficult walk. And over time, then they start developing calluses and then some scars, and then it becomes painful. And the truth is that this deformity in developing countries that they don't have access to care as we do in here in the United States is the number one musculoskeletal disability for these kids.
Mm-hmm. You said how many babies each year are born with it? Nearly 200,000 each year in the world. So if a baby is born with a club foot in the United States, it gets treatment across the board.
We take care usually in the first week of life.
Okay, so tell us about the story of Ignacio Ponseti. You knew him for many years before his death in 2009. He was born in 1914 in Spain. Came to the University of Iowa in 1941. Tell us more about his story and how he developed this almost miraculous treatment for club foot.
Well, he was born in Mallorca in Spain, and then has his education medical school in Barcelona, and he actually finished his medical school just one day before the Spanish Civil War started in 1936. So he joined the army and worked as a captain, as a doctor during the war. One thing that is very important is that he was part of a group that developed the treatment of the wounded in the war. And with the new concepts of wound treatment that we have now, like when you have an accident and you have a fracture that is open. So they were very successful saving limbs and also preventing infections in the wounded. And just remember, 1936, there were no antibiotics. So it was all by taking very good care of the wound and immobilizing the joints. So he worked in this group, and unfortunately he was in the losing side. So he had to go into exile. So he went to France, and after a few months, the government of Mexico accepted the Spanish professionals and gave them a place to work and to live. So he decided to come to Mexico and work as a family doctor in a small little town for about 2 years. During this time, he met a doctor in Mexico, Dr. Farrell, who coincidentally was a fellow here in Iowa back in the 20s with Dr. Steinler, the founder of our department, that is going to be actually next month the 100th anniversary. And he recommended Dr. Ponseti to come to work with Dr. Steinler, and so he did in 1941.
Okay, so before coming to the University of Iowa, his work in the treatment of clubfoot, had that already started, or did that begin here in Iowa?
It did begin here. So he came and did his residency under Dr. Steinler, and when he finished, Dr. Steinler asked him to evaluate the patients that he had treated for clubfoot since he came in 1913. So these patients were about 20, 23, 25 years of age, and Dr. Steinler used to do the treatment like most people by doing surgery, trying to correct and, you know, cut the ligaments and tendons and put the foot straight. And when Dr. Ponseti did this study, they found that most of these patients were not doing very well.
Mm.
When you do surgery in clubfoot, then there's a scar tissue, and in many cases the scar tissue doesn't grow as normal tissue, and then the foot becomes very stiff, and it has higher rates of complications and also relapses or recurrence. It comes back, and then you have to do surgery again. And usually the kids need maybe two or three surgeries by the time they are 14 or 15. So he realized that clubfoot surgery was really not a very good solution for clubfoot. So he started studying, you know, why clubfoot happened, and then how can you, you know, modify the technique, and if he was able to do it with just plaster cast.
And so this is a non-surgical non-invasive treatment, just with plaster casts.
Yes, it's just your hands and plaster casts, and then you mold the cast, and then you do a little bit of stretching, so you take advantage of how the little joints in the foot moves, and then you apply the cast, and what you do is that every week or so, every 5 to 7 days, you stretch a little bit the foot and then put it in a bird position. And so usually in about a month, 3 to 4 weeks, then you have the foot corrected. So mm-hmm. the foot goes from looking like a club to just a normal foot.
How is this at all painful for the patient?
No, this is very gentle. You just do it very, very carefully. You just take advantage of that wonderful stretchability of babies. Mm-hmm. And if you do it in the right way, then the foot really start going into the right direction. It started as a normal foot, and it just during the process of during pregnancy, and we don't know exactly why this happened. It's most likely a genetic component. Then the foot start twisting. The muscles get tight, and they have a tendency to tie it up with growth. So when you do the casting, then you just stretch those muscles and tendons, and then the bones fall in place, and then the foot looks normal.
Mm-hmm. This is the standard, the gold standard, as I mentioned, in treating clubfoot worldwide. What's the success rate?
Well, I can tell you that it's not until about 8 or 10 years ago that this became the standard of care. Unfortunately, the orthopedic community worldwide didn't listen to Dr. Ponseti for 40 years. His first patient was treated in 1948, and he published a paper in 1963 describing the technique, but nobody listened to him. So it was not until the 2000s that people came back, and when he came back to work again after retirement, and he wrote his book in 1996, that people realized that this method was really powerful and you can get corrections. In our hand, it's close to 100%. 95 to 100% is very common worldwide.
Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of meeting Dr. Ponseti when he was alive, and I remember the idea that he has to think of the adults now, the children who became adults who he has treated, who can walk normally. He had thank you pictures all over his office, didn't he? From around the world.
Yeah, from every place. He was a very wonderful person. He was a wonderful human being, and every patient and every family loved him. And the patients that he treated in the 50s, we did a study, 50-year follow-up study. So now they are in 45 to 55.
Yeah.
90% of them had never problems or have no problems, you know, with the feet. So it's not just successful to correct the deformity. Is that it lasts, when it's corrected, it lasts for the life of the patient with no problems in general.
It sounds to me like it's almost akin, and we've got to go to a break here, but, you know, when kids get work done on their teeth to help them grow straight, that they grow straight, they don't have any other problems, and their dental work is good to go for the rest of their lives.
It's exactly the same, and actually for this, it requires a brace to be used at night for, you know, 3 or 4 years, like when you have braces for your teeth, and when you get to 4, 4.5, 5, if the feet are straight, it will be straight for life.
Dr. Jose Marquende is with us. I want to have you please stay with us in our Iowa City studio for a few more minutes, because we do want to talk about the Ponseti International Association. You're the chief medical director with that, and about the need that is international in scope to get more people trained in the Ponseti method. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. It's Iowa Week from Iowa Public Radio News. And when we come back, also we'll talk about the statewide perinatal care program, its origins in the early 1970s, and the remarkable story of how the University of Iowa's College of Medicine was funded almost 100 years ago. Looking back at medical history, some milestones. Iowa Week on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News continues in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We are indeed celebrating Iowa with Iowa Week this week and during this hour of River to River. We're continuing our look at the pioneering work in medicine that has been done in this state. And a little later in the hour, we want to talk about Iowa's statewide perinatal care program. Perhaps you or one of your offspring has benefited from this care program, which helps mothers and newborn babies receive medical care wherever they may be in the state. And then also toward the end of the hour, the remarkable story of how the University of Iowa's College of Medicine was funded almost 100 years ago. It's very interesting. You want to stick around for that. I want to First of all, though, finish up my conversation with Dr. Jose Marquende. He's the chief medical director of the Ponseti International Association. We're talking about the congenital condition called clubfoot. Nearly 200,000 babies worldwide each year are born with this this congenital defect, and the gold standard treatment for clubfoot was developed right here at the University of Iowa in Iowa, the Ponseti method, developed at the University of Iowa by Ignacio Ponseti. He died in 2009. He was born in 1914 in Spain, came to the University of Iowa in 1941 to do this groundbreaking medical work and development that has changed and benefited so many lives. And Dr. Jose Marquende, let's talk a little bit for a couple minutes about the work of the Ponseti International Association. You are traveling internationally, I understand, quite a bit during the year, involved with the association. What are your goals now that it's recognized this is the standard, this non-invasive, non-surgical treatment to correct in nearly 100% of the cases clubfoot?
Yes. The vision of Ponseti International is actually a work of clubfoot disability. The main reason is because in developing countries, kids don't get treatment, so they get disabled. So the beautiful, wonderful method that Dr. Ponseti gave us is the becoming the standard of care. And so the goal of the association is to is a professional organization of members from all over the world. We have about 100 countries now represented. And what we doing is to provide educational programs both for the professionals and also for the public, and also help the professionals and in each country to develop national programs for the treatment of clubfoot.
How far are you? We mentioned earlier in the program that a child born in the United States with clubfoot is treated and treated effectively and pretty much immediately when that is recognized. How far are we away from that standard, that level of care worldwide? Because that's really what you're striving for, isn't it?
Yes. I think it depends on the country, and it goes a little bit for, you know, where's the development in the country. But I will say that half of the countries in the world, about 100, most kids don't get treatment until they are very late, 3-4 years. And there's probably millions, 2-3 millions, we don't know for sure, of adults that had never been treated. So we have a lot of work to do, but we hope that in the next maybe 10 years, 15 years, we implement systems in each country so the kids are identified early. And you will be discussing here later the maternal health and neonatal issues. So in every country, the kids are identified early, are referred to centers where the Ponseti method is practiced. So there's not going to be any more disability in the future.
We can look forward to that day. Thanks to you, Dr. Jose Marquende, and first and foremost to the work of Ignacio Ponseti at the University of Iowa. Thank you for coming into our studio today, Doctor.
Thank you.
And continuing our look back at some historical developments in medicine in Iowa, we want to talk now to another doctor in our Iowa City studio, Dr. Herman Hein. He's a retired neonatologist, an emeritus professor of pediatrics at the University of Iowa. Welcome to you, Dr. Hein.
Thank you, Ben.
And we want to talk about Iowa's statewide perinatal pro-care program. It's helped mothers and newborn babies receive some needed medical care no matter where they are in the state. And you developed this program way back in the early 1970s. Take us back to the time before this program existed. What was the need that was identified?
From 1968 to 1973, I was in private general pediatric practice in Dubuque, and although my interests really were not focused on the newborn at that time, it was becoming obvious that we could do a lot more for the sick newborn and also for high-risk pregnant women. So in Dubuque, we sort of took the bull by the horns and developed some special care units. We put together a small unit up in the fifth floor at Mercy Hospital. I think we had 6 beds for babies. We trained some nurses. I got the interest of some of the other pediatricians, and we kind of focused much more on the newborn, and we even developed a little transport system. Interestingly, it was done with a local funeral director. We put together a gerrymandered kind of a transport isolette with the help of a guy named Gene Siegert, who was that funeral director, and we made our first trip to Maquoketa, Iowa, for a sick newborn, brought the baby back to Dubuque, And fortunately, the baby did very well. And each day I would call the local doctor and let him know how things were going. And then he would ask me a few questions, you know, could we have done things a little better maybe? Would you consider coming over to Makokata and reviewing some similar records and putting on a little educational program for it? So I did that. That worked very well. And that was where I got the idea for the statewide perinatal care program. If a team of people who deal with newborn problems, the obstetrician, neonatologist, obstetric nurse, newborn nurse, nutritionist, would go out to the various hospitals, review their care, and then provide on-the-spot education to correct whatever deficiencies in care were found, that hopefully would improve the outcome of all babies and hopefully for mothers would improve the care of mothers as well.
Mm-hmm. And back then, what type of specific conditions required more than what the local town doctor or hospital, local hospital could provide?
So much of it was tied up with prematurity. Babies' lungs are just not mature enough. They required assistance in their breathing. And most of these small hospitals didn't have that kind of facility. And the physicians didn't have the background, didn't have the training to do that. So what we set out to do was to develop a regional system. So within a general area, you would have one hospital that would provide those services that the smaller hospitals could relate to. And indeed, when we started our visitation program, there were like 141 hospitals doing OB at that time. We visited all of them. And we asked the question, where do you send your sick moms, where do you send your sick babies when you have a problem? And that's how we determine the naturally occurring referral areas. I don't think doctors like to have anything shoved down their throat. So we did what was a natural sort of thing. And I think it has indeed worked very well. We developed the regionalized system of health care on that basis, and it continues to this day.
So if we picture a map of the state of Iowa, and we have that clearly Dubuque in northeast Iowa, then down to Makokata a bit. So what has happened is that no matter where you are in Iowa, if you're in an outlying, a rural area, you fall into one of these districts, and the doctors in that district know for some type of specialized care, they always have a connection to a facility and doctors with knowledge that may be needed in such cases.
Absolutely. Now, as time has gone on, Ben, we have attracted other neonatologists. The University of Iowa isn't the only place that has neonatologists or specialists in OB. They're in Cedar Rapids, they're in Des Moines, Waterloo, in Sioux City, and so forth. So we really have, over this 30-some-year period, seen quite a change in the kinds of physicians that live in these various communities. But it's still based on that same old system, that regionalized system that we developed.
We hear so much about the doctor and nurse shortage, especially in rural parts of the country. Is this something that helps helps that situation, this type of network?
Yeah, I think it definitely does, because when you've trained the basic caregiver, the general pediatrician, the general obstetrician, to do things that are at maybe the first couple steps of intensive care but aren't the ultimate that, say, a University of Iowa or Des Moines Methodist or someone like that would have, yeah, I think you definitely have expanded that ability. And we kind of developed the new concept of the regional level 2 center. Mm-hmm. People think of regional centers all being level 3. Well, Iowa was the first to do this, and in fact, I took a little criticism initially because of this, but it worked. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the mortality rates, initially, if it didn't matter what size hospital, group of hospitals you had, the mortality rate was about 15 per 1,000, and it was straight across the board. Now, as we look at it, those numbers have dropped down to almost nothing in the littler hospitals. They are still a little on the high side, relatively speaking, at the referral centers, but that's exactly what you'd expect. And how much effect has it had on outcomes? Well, if we deliver about 40,000 babies a year, the rates used to be 15 per 1,000. They very rapidly dropped to 5 per 1,000. You can do the quick multiplication and see that's about 400 babies a year.
Did you have any idea 30 years ago in 1970, well, in the early 1970s, more than 30 years ago, but 30 years of this program as such, that you would have the impact that you're quoting back to us right now?
No, I certainly didn't. I thought it was a good, solid idea. And, you know, when you're out preaching the gospel of quality care, it should do some good. And I think that's really what the University of Iowa is all about, is sharing those things with other hospitals. And so I thought that was a very natural thing to do. Obviously, I didn't stay in Dubuque and do this. I was recruited to the university in 1973, as a matter of fact, to start this very program.
Now, is this a method, a practice, a program that other states have emulated? Did it?
Yes, indeed. I think it's pretty safe to say that now across the nation we have a regionalized system of care that exists in almost every state. They're not all patterned after ours necessarily, but some of them certainly were.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any sense in to quantify the help that's been given through this program over the 30, 40 years, the babies who've gotten that extra bit of care they needed who otherwise wouldn't have? Is it thousands, more than the thousands, tens of thousands? We don't
know.
Well,
it's been going on since 1973. And if you look at the mortality rates over that time, they dropped steadily. So it's obviously in the thousands.
Okay. Dr. Herman Hine, a retired neonatologist and emeritus professor of pediatrics at the University of Iowa. He developed a program way back in 1973 called Exists Today and is emulated across the country, Iowa's statewide perinatal care program. Dr. Hine, thank you for coming into our studio today.
My pleasure, Ben. Thank you.
And the last little item we want to talk about, not a little item, actually an interesting historical item that I had not known about, perhaps you not either. We want to talk about something called the Flexner Report. Here to explain that to us, Dr. Stan Thompson, Emeritus Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of Iowa in our Iowa City studio. Dr. Thompson, welcome to you.
Pleasure.
We want to go back to Iowa's medical history in the early part of the 20th century to a man named Abraham Flexner and his 1910 report, How It Changed Medical Education Across the United States. I want to mention, too, that you, Dr. Thompson, will be speaking at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in the Hardin Library for Health Sciences this coming Thursday at 5:30 in the evening on this very topic. But we want to have you give us a brief overview of Abraham Flexner and the Flexner Report. Set the scene for us, if you could, before this report, the condition, the state of medical education in this country, and the deficiencies that the Flexner identified.
Well, there were a lot of small medical colleges that didn't do much except offer a few lectures and then give out a diploma. But and there were colleges who did, of course, quite a bit more than that. When Flexner was from a large family in Louisville, and he was a bright boy, and his older brother became a pharmacist and said to him, "Abe, I want you to go to college, and I'm going to give you the money." It was not a wealthy family. And I want you to go to Johns Hopkins. So at about 17 or so, off he went to Hopkins undergraduate school. And his only thought in mind was that he wanted to learn Greek. So he wasn't that interested in medicine. He was bored with what the teacher was doing in the classroom. So he asked if he could sort of teach himself. He put the Greek verbs on one side of the little slip of paper and the translation on the other, filled this bag full of them, and he would pull these out. And if he knew what was on correct answer on the other side, he put it aside, and if it was wrong, he put it back in the bag. And in less time than the usual course, he had taught himself more Greek than most of his classmates had learned. Mm-hmm. So he did his whole 4 years in 2 years. And he went back to Louisville and taught high school. Well, it was pretty obvious that he was going places, but he ended up in New York helping people do public good. That is, the philanthropists needed some advice about where to give money, and he was one of those who looked into it and made recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1909, the Carnegie Institute said, there are all these medical schools out there, you know. Probably some of them could do better. And they sent him on a sort of tour of the country where he would visit as many medical schools as he could and write up some comments. Well, he apparently wrote up some quite scathing comments, and many schools closed because they weren't doing very much. And he was very much opposed to homeopathic medicine and medical schools. He didn't think that that medical training should be based on faith-based.
In fact, wasn't it true that he exposed some shortcomings at the University of Iowa's medical training program?
Actually, he telegrammed the president of the university here from St. Louis. He was on his way. He was going to be arriving that evening, and President McLean actually went. This is December 09. went to the railway station and picked him up, and they took him to the hospital, which was not yet completed, the hospital on Iowa Avenue, and he got a brief look around and asked a few questions, and it turned out that there were no hospital charts. The doctor who admitted the patient took the charts home to his office, and there were only a few doctors in Iowa City anyway, and there was never any instruction of medical students. No, they never made rounds to see what the patient was like or talk to him. So he didn't have a very high opinion of what was going on.
But it was some of the same things he was finding in other medical facilities, teaching facilities across the country.
All around the country, yes. Mm-hmm. And so Dr. McLean may have given him dinner, and then he took him to the railroad station to get the overnight train to Omaha. And it was a busy trip for the man, but he went right back to New York and wrote it all up, and it appeared in June of 1910. And it was a sensation because everywhere in medicine, they were being told, you don't know how to do this. You're messing it up. You need to have better standards. And that was the Hopkins boy speaking.
Right, right.
And he was about 43, I think, when he came through Iowa. And there was a man on the Board of Regents. It was called the Iowa State Board of Education at the time, and named he lived in Cedar Rapids,
mm-hmm.
and
William Boyd.
William Boyd, and mm-hmm. William Boyd went. He called him up and arranged for an appointment in New York, and he went on the train to New York for a couple of days on
right,
the train
right.
and got there and had a chat with them, and these two people seemed to like each other. They were about the same age.
Yeah.
They both taught high school when they were kids, and now they were involved in money. I mean, Boyd was a banker in Cedar Rapids.
Not to hurry you too much. We have just a couple more minutes here. It's a fascinating story. Do go on, but we're coming to the end of our hour, Dr.
Okay.
Thompson.
Yeah? Well, at any rate, their relationship remained for 10 or more years in abeyance because mostly the World War and so on. And finally, Flexner came to make a visit in Iowa City in 1920. And it was apparently he was getting his arguments together to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
And with some difficulty, he raised money mostly from the Rockefellers. And he arranged for people in Iowa City to find out how much it would cost if we had a 700-bed hospital and all the facilities for radiology and bacteriology and pathology.
And the long and short of that, the end of the story is that a tremendous amount of money came to.
Yes.
From where?
It was decided they needed $4.9 million to do this, and he went to New York and started raising money. He ran into some opposition here and there, and it's mostly Rockefeller money, and he raised half of it, which the state could have to build this if they raised an equal amount.
And if not for that money, the University of Iowa the famed worldwide University of Iowa College of Medicine, hospitals and clinics would not be nearly what it is today.
I think much smaller. In fact, if it had been closed, as Flexner had suggested, we'd be sending our kids to Minneapolis or Chicago.
Okay. What a fascinating story. Thank you very much, Dr. Stan Thompson. I know there are a lot of fascinating details to find out about it, but you've given us a great overview of the early history of the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, the College of Medicine. Dr. Stan Thompson, Emeritus Professor of Ophthalmology at the University of Iowa. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. Tomorrow on this program, we continue Iowa Week, and we'll look at historic legal cases connected with Iowa, also activists. And we'll talk, for instance, about Tinker v. Des Moines Independent Community School District. It's a milestone not only in Iowa legal history, but in the history of our country, decided by the Supreme Court in 1969, determined the First Amendment rights of students in public schools. Wearing of black armbands. We'll tell that story tomorrow. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.